Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a community credit union with 21 branches and a full suite of digital services. WSECU supports 9 regional farmers markets across Washington State and invites listeners to enjoy the bounty of summer at their local market. More information at WSECU.org.
I should bring up my little spreadsheet that actually has the breakdown for each. I actually did the math in an I'm a geek, so what can I say?
That geek is Arik Cohen. He works at Microsoft. This geek is Gabriel Spitzer, and I host Sound Effect on 88.5. So Arik found himself embroiled in an unusual stats project, calculating, essentially, the probability of his own existence.
The situation in my family is all 4 of my grandparents are Holocaust survivors. When I was first approached about, hey, you should write your story, they said, wow, that's really rare. And I was like, it's not that rare. It happened to me. It happened to my brother. It can't be that rare. As always, when you kind of look at your own thing, you end up where you end up, and you don't really think of what were the odds that got you there. So when I actually started doing kind of the math and figuring out what all of that entails, and then getting some of the stories from my grandparents, and realize how there are random moments in time that a decision went one way or another, and without it, I'm not here.
So how did you go about actually assigning numbers to these real-life situations?
So I'm pretty sure my stats professor in college would not necessarily approve of the methodology that I used. But I started with some basics. For example, my grandparents on my father's side. They were in Oradea, which is the 3rd largest ghetto in Romania. They were then sent to Auschwitz. So there were 28,000 Jews that were sent from Oradea to Auschwitz. There were 2,000 that returned. And then I have the stories from my grandfather's village. Well, there were about 500 Jews that were in the village. There are 2 people that survived from the war. They took a bunch of people out to a big pit in the forest and killed them. Well, why was he one of the adult males that wasn't picked out of that? Well, he had the lumber mill and the fish pond, and they were trying to get him to sign over the paperwork. So they needed something from him. So he avoided the first round of shooting. And then when you go 1 out of 8, 1 out of 100, 1 out of 2,000 out of 22,000, and you start multiplying it all out, the odds get pretty great.
Yeah. So let's do like a quick 10 second refresher on how you compound all those odds.
Yeah.
So you're basically multiplying fractions.
Yeah. You just start multiplying the fractions together, right? So the classic example is, what are the odds that a coin flip comes up heads twice, right? So it's 1 out of 2 the first time. It's 1 out of 2 the second time. If you multiply those together, if you're going to get 2 in the same order, it's 1 out of 4.
Yeah. So if you're looking at 1 out of 250 times, 1 out of 8 times, whatever, that bottom number adds up pretty fast.
It adds up in a hurry. And for me, it adds up to a number that was unfathomable when I first saw it.
What is that number then?
Just the odds that all 4 grandparents survive is 1 in 963,379,200.
Did that number surprise you?
Yeah, I mean, it's about 4 times less likely for me than winning the Mega Millions.
Wow.
Needless to say, since I've figured these numbers out, I don't buy lottery tickets. I'm done.
You already won the lottery, Arik.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no. That's the way I look at it. I mean, I won the lottery multiple times over just getting here.
Today on Sound Effect, what are the odds? We'll hear stories of how lives were changed by unbelievably unlikely events. From nuns hit by a rogue wave to a weird coincidence that had one Washington town preparing to battle Martians. That's all ahead on Sound Effect from 88.5 KNKX. On now to A Brush with Death, the story of a disaster and the man who probably shouldn't have survived it if not for a tiny bureaucratic quirk of fate. A heads up that this story contains some graphic descriptions that can be a little tough to listen to. Sound Effect contributor Dominic Black has the story.
It was about 5:30 in the afternoon by the time Bob Hofferber reached the finance office. He was preparing to leave Ladd Air Force Base in Fairbanks, Alaska, where he'd been based for the last 18 months. It was November the 28th, 1952, and he was going to fly down to McChord Air Force Base on a Douglas C-54G Skymaster, stopping off in Anchorage to pick up extra passengers on the way. Bob's wife, Dolores, also lived in Fairbanks, and she was going to follow him down the next morning. So all Bob had to do was check out of LAD Air Force Base. He had to go through this process, make sure he didn't have any equipment, make sure he didn't have any cold weather clothing that was government issue, make sure he didn't have any fines outstanding at the base library. So by the time 5:30 rolls around, he's pretty much done with this process, and the finance office is his last stop.
They went through my records and they discovered an error on there. Some of my records showed that I was still single. They didn't have me down as married. And they said, you'll have to get this retyped, corrected, and then bring it back. And I said, my office is closed. I mean, those guys, they didn't care. It's just tough. Figure it out. So I was mad. And my wife was staying with some friends. We'd given up our apartment. So I called her and told her what was happening. And I decided I was going to try to get a ticket with her and go in the morning.
One. This is Murray Morgan. I am standing, as I broadcast, at the scene of a crash which has taken someplace between 30 and 35 lives.
Tacoma-born writer and historian Murray Morgan worked as a journalist in 1952. This recording was found in his study after his death. A graphic location account on a small 7-inch reel of unlabeled magnetic audio tape.
A military air transport plane coming in from Anchorage, Alaska, tried to land at the McChord Air Base shortly before 1 this morning. The plane made a ground control approach, that is an approach with radar help, to the field, and then circled away. As it circled away, it dropped low, struck the tops of some trees, and crashed.
I'd sent a telegram to my parents the day before telling them on what flight I was going to be on.
So your parents thought you were on that flight,
right?
And so they heard about the crash.
Right. And they lived in South Tacoma, not too far from where the airplane crashed. In fact, my dad drove up there and looked at it. And so they thought at the time I was on the airplane.
This is a dreadful and eerie scene out here. It is cold and it is dark and it is foggy. There are flames from the plane still smoldering an hour and a half after the crash. All around me, there are Corps men, aid Corps men, their white helmets, moving with litters, searching for the bodies of the dead who are lying in this field of scrub oak and bunch grass. Men with flashlights are turning them around, and wherever they turn, they come on scenes of horror.
Did your dad ever talk about what he saw that night?
Yeah. Yeah, he said he went up there and he saw people still strapped in their seats, burning. Then it was a total disaster scene, which was tough for him to look at the time. He said later he doesn't even know why he went up there.
I have here two of the first people to reach the scene of the accident. Sir, your name again?
Art Getchman.
Just pick up the story. You were in your car and the plane came over?
Yes, I was. Well, this big ball of fire come over my car. It couldn't have been very high because it just warmed my car up right away. I didn't even think it was a plane. I couldn't hear no motors or anything, just a big swoosh when it went over. And I followed.
When I seen it land over in the field, it burst into flame right away, and I got the car and shot down there. And the first thing I jumped out of the car, I heard the little somebody screaming. I run over, and I'd say the boy's about 5 years old. He was still alive. And I think I counted 14 up in this end. They were all dead. And the baby out in the, where the biggest part of the flame was, we couldn't get there to him or her. But I think they were dead anyway.
The bodies are being put under brown army blankets. From time to time, the blankets are lifted so that the number of dead may be counted. Under one blanket, I saw two small, terribly burned children, 4 or 5 years old, and right next to them was the headless body of a woman.
I didn't find out about the crash till I woke up in the morning, and they had a little table radio by where we were sleeping. I heard for the first time there that the aircraft had crashed. So my wife and I were just totally shocked. And all we could think about was some way letting our parents know that we were not on that airplane.
Normally he'd have sent a telegram, since phoning home wasn't really an option for somebody of his rank. But this isn't a normal morning, and so as he's getting ready to turn in his corrected report to the finance office, the phone rings.
Somebody else answered the phone, and here it said, "Here, it's your mother," so who was greatly relieved, of course, and I told her that we would be coming home.
There were 39 people on the plane that night, and ultimately only two survived. Airman Curtis Redd, who was 23 years old, and a young boy called Joseph Yakovetti, who was 8 years old, and who lost his whole family. Bob Hofferber went on to work as a radar engineer, and he and his wife Dolores had three children. But over the years, since that night, November 28th, 1952, he's thought many times about the families who were lost, and about the quirk, the chance occurrence, a typing mistake that kept him off that plane.
I've always felt grateful that for some reason we were both spared. And I've always been fairly religious, so I attached a lot of that to being religious, and just felt lucky that I was able to have a family and live a pretty good life.
That story from sound effect contributor Dominic Black. True luck consists not in holding the best of the cards at the table. Luckiest is he who knows just when to rise and go home. So says John Milton Hay, a guy I found on Google. Anyway, it reminded me of a certain jazz host right here at our radio station who's long been fond of trying his luck at the poker table. So as part of our What Are the Odds show, I give you the first installment of Dick Stein's Card Room Tales.
I knew these two ladies that I really loved that used to come into the card room. Ermengarde, who was a very sweet, grandmotherly German lady, and Miss Terry, a lady of also a certain age, who was of Japanese extraction. I used to call these two the Axis partners because they were just as thick as thieves and always came in. They'd bring bags of candy and stuff they'd hand out to the other players. They were lovely, lovely people, but very different. As I said, Ermengarde was very grandmotherly and earthy. Miss Terry was very much an old school lady. She always dressed very elegantly. She was dignified. She was a warm person. and just commanded great respect and a very conservative player. If Miss Terry even so much as called in a hand, you needed to be very wary. If she raised, probably it would be best just to leave the table and then leave town with no forwarding address. It was like that. But everyone loved and respected Miss Terry. Well, in this card room, unlike almost all of them, it was in a riverboat type of a deal. It was up on the top deck, and it actually had windows, very unusual for any kind of a card room. And I was playing there one afternoon, and Miss Terry was at the table, and the sun was shining through the windows and apparently getting in her eyes. And she turned to one of the other players, another regular by the name of Oscar, who was this huge, big guy, very nice guy, but a large, large guy with those big, round sausage arms that the really strong guys have, okay? And in fact, I think one of the jobs that he had was he worked security at rock concerts, okay? So Miss Terry turns to Oscar and she says, "Oh, Oscar, dear, that sun is getting in my eyes. Would you mind closing those blinds?" "Sure thing, Miss Terry," he says. And he goes to the window. He's starting to close the blind. Some other player at the table I'd never seen before said, "Hey, wait a second. Maybe I'd like a little sunlight in here." And Oscar loomed over him, and nobody could loom like Oscar. And he said, "Miss Terry wants them closed." And that was the end of the story.
Stay tuned for more of Stein's Poker Table Fables later in the show. Welcome back to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and on today's show, we're asking, what are the odds? This is a story about one of those turning points, a moment when a totally freak occurrence appears and changes lives forever. The setting is the Washington coast, the time is the late 70s, and the characters are a group of Catholic nuns. Sound Effect contributor Ryan McDonald picks up the story from there.
Rosemary Thielman and Roberta LaManna are both now in their 70s. They have been nuns their entire adult lives. Today they're at their kitchen table in their home in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, where they've lived together for the last 27 years.
I like that picture of all three of us with our broken legs.
Sprawled out in front of them is their accident album, a scrapbook filled with photos and newspaper articles and lots of memories. Yeah.
Local nuns injured at Ocean Beach. Two former Immaculate Conception school teachers and another one from Everett were injured.
But it's this moment that happened 40 years ago that shaped their friendship and connected them in ways that would only be understood with the breadth of time and laughter. Lots of laughter.
Do I have to do this again to get skinny again? It was my automatic diet.
In April of 1977, Rosemary, Roberta, and three of their friends, Shirley, Peggy, and Joe Cerie, took a week-long vacation to Grayland Beach State Park. All five nuns crammed into a tiny camping trailer that they parked right next to the beach.
The last day, and we were going to go down to the beach for the last time, the sun was out. And it was a beautiful day. Absolutely gorgeous day, but freezing cold. So we, packed everything up and walked down to the beach. And during the week, there hadn't been any logs on the beach at all. And when we got down there, there was one log. So we were all standing on the log and we were, giving thanks for the nice week, even though it rained all week.
And at that point, the water started coming in. And it wasn't like a tsunami where you'd go, "Oh, I've got to get out of here." It was just water from the ocean that just kept coming, like the whole ocean decided to come right in our direction.
We were about a block or so from the water. We were quite a distance from the water. All of a sudden, you could just see the water rising. I didn't want to get my shoes wet. Another sister, Peggy, and I, and Rosemary jumped off the log and started running up the beach a bit, up to the sand dunes. When I turned around and looked at Shirley and the other sister, Jo Cerie, who were on the log, they were thrown up in the air and then came crashing down. Peggy and I were way up in the sand dunes, and I was wet way up to my waist. Rosemary started to go back down to help Shirley because a log had come and pinned her leg down.
So she called out in a kind of firm, but rather desperate voice, "If another wave comes in, I will drown." So I stopped running up to the sand dunes where I was going to join the others. When I heard Shirley call out, I thought, I'd better try to go help. And I don't know if I was motivated by love or by guilt. I knew I didn't want to spend the rest of my life feeling guilty that I didn't try to do something. At that point, I looked up in front of me, and there was a huge log coming in on a wave. And I remember thinking, I could jump over that. Whatever log hit me, it whacked me down into the sand. And my face felt like it was 40 feet down in the sand. So I lifted up my head so that I could breathe. And at that point, the log whacked over the back of my head. And I could still hear that sound, that cracking sound as it hit my head. Roberta and Peggy came out of the sand dunes and pulled me toward the water because the log that had gone over me was coming back to land on me. And that's how people die. As I was laying on the beach, I began to fade out. And I thought, I'm dying. And it was a strange feeling. I was so terrified of dying in those days. My God was a very judging God. And I, in my mind, was a really bad person. I had a rotten attitude about myself, and I felt like I was rotten. I was dying, but I felt so peaceful. Felt just serenely held and protected and safe. And not worried. You know, I'm such a worrywart. I wasn't worried. I was okay. My only sadness was, I'm so sorry I can't tell everybody. I want them to know it's okay.
The sisters had been struck by a rogue wave. They can also be called a sneaker wave or a freak wave. These waves were an urban legend until they were first recorded by scientists in 1984. They come with no warning and are extremely dangerous even to boats as big as freight liners. That entire week, the sisters were the only ones on the campground, until the night before when they noticed some other campers had arrived. It was these people who brought them blankets after the accident and prayed with them until the ambulance arrived. Later on, the paramedics told them people do not survive accidents like this.
It's hard to describe the feeling of it. I was almost out of body. You go through it and you do what you need to do. And then afterward, fell apart. I remember sobbing that night to see our friends hurt so seriously. And there was some, I think, guilt of not being hurt, that we weren't hurt. After the ambulance had taken them off the beach and they went to the hospital, Peggy and I went back to the trailer and we changed our clothes because we were wet from everything. And then we had a drink of scotch. As Rosemary said, "What? You didn't come immediately?" We said, no, we had to kind of gather our wits about ourselves. And it worked. Scotch worked.
The women suffered two broken legs, one cracked pelvis, one smashed ankle, an eye injury, and a very large hematoma. When the log hit the back of Rosemary's head, it shattered her skull and caused serious nerve damage and facial paralysis. She couldn't close her eyes or her mouth. To this day, she struggles with eating and talking. During their recovery, Roberta continued to work as a schoolteacher, but she would make the hour-long drive from Seattle to Olympia every day to be with her friends.
I think during the dark nights in the hospital, the emotions were definitely ones of depression, of anxiety. I don't remember crying. My eyes were so dry, I probably couldn't cry. Because that was another thing when your eyes are open all the time. But I just remember the fear. And then just the music would be so calming. That song, Be Not Afraid. I go before you always.
I go before you always.
Come follow me and I will give you rest.
Come follow me and I will give you rest.
That could really calm me. My family can't understand this, but I had a terrible, terrible self-concept. And then add the guilt. So when I had that moment at the beach, it was very profound changing moment for me that I can be loved. In the hospital at St. Peter's, I felt the first few days that I was reaching, trying to reach that God. And finally, I remember thinking, I don't need to reach out for God. God is right here with me. And that was like revolutionary for me. It was like a total pivot of who I was, because suddenly, no matter how good or bad or whatever I was or thought I was, God was there, and God being there was bigger than anything about me. That really changed my whole, not just that moment, but my whole future about how I chose to live and what I chose to believe.
I think I always had a strong sense that God was present with us during that whole experience. And that's pretty much how it's been for me all my life, is a real sense of God's presence in whatever I'm doing, wherever I am.
So my face has been a huge challenge for years, but what we didn't know then that we learned later is that nerves do continue to regenerate. The doctor had told me at one point that I would only get back what I got back in a year. But I've continued. I still think to this day to heal. And that's why that word healing is a precious, holy word to me. I don't know why we were all there that day. And I don't know why all that happened. But I know that many, many miracles have come from that. Many. Even 40 years later.
That story was produced by contributors Ryan McDonald and Emma Jones. You can see archival photos and newspaper clippings on their gorgeous website, thesistersoftherogueway.com. You're tuned to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Today the theme is What Are the Odds? For Jason Detweiler, on any given day, the odds are about 1,000,000 to 1. Detweiler's an assistant professor of physics at the University of Washington, and he's on the hunt for a natural phenomenon that is insanely rare. But there's a good payoff. If he does find it, it may explain why the universe exists. Now, this gets at a huge mystery. Based on the way we think physics works, all the stuff in the early universe should have eaten itself, leaving nothing. And yet there seems to be something. So all this may have to do with these minuscule, invisible things called neutrinos.
Well, it's in a sense the tiniest of the fundamental particles. It's actually the second most ubiquitous particle in the universe. So despite the fact that people don't typically know much about it, it's everywhere. It's all around us. They're always zipping through us.
Wait a minute. They're zipping through our bodies?
Yes.
So right now, like I'm holding my hand out in front of me right now, are there neutrinos passing through me?
Yeah, I think the number, it's something on the order of like hundreds of trillions of neutrinos are passing through your hand each second.
Wow. Yeah. And where are they coming from?
Most of those are coming from the sun.
These little particles flying through you right now are created in certain nuclear reactions. So once in a while, an atom, say carbon, will change into another element, say oxygen, two spots down on the periodic table. Detweiler is actually using a much more obscure element, the metal germanium. Anyway, that atomic transformation has an intimidating sounding name, double beta decay. And when it happens, the nucleus of the atom belches out these two neutrinos.
And actually, we've observed that process where that transition happens and you get two neutrinos out of that.
And how common or rare is that process?
We characterize the rarity or in terms of what's called the half-life. And the half-life is a measure of, you know, if you get 1,000 of these nuclei together, you wait one half-life and half of them will have undergone this decay. So the half-life of germanium-76 double beta decay is something on the order of 10 to the 21 years, which is more than 10 to the 10 times the age of the universe.
So wait, 10 to the 10, that's 10 billion, right?
Yes.
So for if you had 1,000 atoms, the amount of time you would expect it to take for 500 of those to undergo this interaction that you're talking about is 10 billion times longer than the universe has existed.
That's correct.
How have you found one of those?
So the only way to overcome a timescale like that is to get an extremely large number of these atoms together. So if we get a lump of germanium together, say a kilogram of germanium together, then we can expect to see something on the order of one per day of these double beta decays.
So that's a normal double beta decay. It's uncommon, but it happens. Detweiler, though, is searching for a much rarer bird, double beta decay where no neutrinos are produced, probably because they annihilated each other. See, the laws of physics predict that any process that creates matter, like the Big Bang, should make an equal amount of antimatter. And when a particle meets its antimatter evil twin, they cancel each other out. That elusive neutrino-less reaction would reinforce the theory that maybe neutrinos are their own evil twin.
And that's a very exciting possibility.
Why is that exciting?
Good question. So we look out in the universe, and the universe is made up of matter, and we don't see big pockets of antimatter because that would result in a big annihilation, and all of the antimatter would have destroyed all the matter, and we wouldn't be here.
So the fact that we are here suggests that there's stuff we don't know, right? Because since we observe matter and not antimatter, there must have been more matter, so there was some left over after all the annihilating happened?
Yeah, so there has to be some process somewhere in physics that we haven't discovered yet that allows for the creation of a slight excess of matter over antimatter. And this is where the neutrino comes in. The idea is you have some really heavy sort of big brother of the neutrino, and it could decay to matter slightly more often than that particle's decay to antimatter.
Let me make sure I understand. So the Big Bang, mm-hmm. in the first sort of microseconds or nanoseconds or whatever after the Big Bang, you got all this new stuff and a bunch of its matter and a bunch of its antimatter. And then this one kind of particle, as it cools, it would have to be unique in the universe in that it would make more matter than antimatter in order for this to explain why we're all here.
Yes. Yeah.
So if you find neutrino-less double beta decay, which I feel like we should come up with an acronym or a nickname for, call it a jelly donut.
Yeah.
Would that be offensive to you?
No, not really.
All right. So you're looking for this jelly donut that if it exists, you would say, all right, at least we didn't disprove this leading theory, right?
Right.
So let's zoom out again. You told me that the regular beta decay, this is your garden variety interaction where an atom jumps two places on the periodic table.
Was that double beta decay?
Double beta decay.
Yes.
Thank you. And you said that if we have 1,000 atoms, half of them would undergo that in about 10 billion times the life of the universe.
Yes.
How rare do we think the jelly donut is?
If you observe 100,000 of these regular double beta decays, you wouldn't see a jelly donut yet. You'd have to see at least 1,000,000 before you hope to see one of these jelly donuts.
What do you think it would be like, though, to find it?
Oh, it'd be tremendously exciting. It would be the first physical process that humans have observed in which matter is created without the accompanying antimatter. It would be groundbreaking. This is all like a job where I get to solve puzzles like that every day.
Can we dig in on the puzzle thing a little bit more?
Yeah.
Like, I would love for you to psychoanalyze yourself a little bit. Okay. Why do you think it is so satisfying to solve a puzzle, especially one of those kind of physics or mathematical type puzzles that has to do with the nature of the universe?
There's something about like a really good math problem where you start working it out and it kind of looks like a mess for a while, and then everything simplifies down to something that's beautiful and concise. Here's a puzzle that nobody's ever encountered before.
The fact of the universe is an incredible thing. The fact of us being able to understand the laws that make it the way it is, to me, is even more amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I've been thinking about that actually a lot lately. You know, in a good sci-fi movie, you'll often have some sort of character or being that's highly evolved and is, you know, more intelligent than humans in some way. You compare us to, say, a dog or something like that, and our minds can conceive so much more of these technical aspects of the universe than that more primitive mind, at least we believe so. And it just makes me wonder, you know, to what extent do our brains, our capacity to understand, limit us from seeing beyond what we can see? Well, that's a very interesting question to me.
Well, Jason Detweiler is an assistant professor of physics at the University of Washington. Thank you so much for coming in and talking neutrinos with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to buy you a jelly donut.
Great.
This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Our theme this week is What Are the Odds? And I am now here in Concrete, Washington, in Skagit Valley, with Valerie Stafford. And Val, you operate something called the Ghost Walks on Saturdays in October. So I'm going to ask you to kind of reenact a piece of that presentation, the part where you come to this very prominent historical wild coincidence that unfolded right here in Concrete.
So on October 30th, 1938, if you were listening to one of the two stations that you were able to get in Concrete, Washington, one of them was playing the Chase and Sanborn Hour, and it was the ventriloquist and his dummy, Charlie McCarthy. That's what a lot of people were listening to.
No. Why? Well, you've been telling entirely too many lies.
I don't actually lie, Mr. Bergen. I just transpose the truth into another key.
Yeah.
But a lot of other people were listening to CBS and the theater programs that they had been running them, and Orson Welles had done a number of them already. So there you were. It was 5 o'clock in the evening, and your family was gathered around the radio, and so you turned it on, and you heard the beginning of the War of the Worlds.
The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
If you were not one of those people tuned into that station, let's say you were listening to the Charlie McCarthy program on the other station, a lot of people did what we do right now. Instead of channel surfing, it was radio dial spinning, and they went to the other station. So all of a sudden, you might have found yourself listening to the War of the Worlds program and not even know what that program is about.
To sleep and dreaming.
Yes?
I seen a kind of greenish streak and then zingo. Something smacked the ground. Knocked me clear out of my chair.
Well, were you frightened, Mr. Wilmot?
Well, I ain't quite sure. I reckon I was kind of riled.
Well, thank you, Mr. Wilmot. Thank you very much.
You want me to tell
you? No, that's quite all right. That's plenty. Ladies and gentlemen.
I would say that was about 30 minutes into the program. And so it's really getting bad. And this next little part is where Concrete, all 1,000 people, here's what they heard next, right before something very interesting happened in our town.
Private citizens and public officials, all of you, the urgent need of calm and resourceful action. Fortunately, this formidable enemy is still confined to a comparatively small area, and we may place our faith in the military force.
All of a sudden, one of our substations exploded. And all the lights went out. All the electricity was gone in Concrete. So people who were listening to the radio program, I mean, what would you think, right? And so they were fairly convinced that the Martians had landed, even though most of the things were on the East Coast. They still, I mean, how would you know? So the lights were out. You had nobody to communicate with. There were no other ways to talk with anybody. People were running out into the street. They were leaving their homes. They were getting in their cars. They were trying to get out of town. Here on Main Street in concrete, people were actually running into the street trying to figure out what was happening.
How do you imagine that would have felt and looked?
Here's what I heard happened with some people. Some guys got their guns and decided they were going to go out into the street and shoot the Martians as they came into town. Other people, we understand that a lot of the guys went up into the woods to protect their moonshine stills. We heard a story of another man who was actually a minister in town who jumped into his car with his family, and he was determined to get to Bellingham where his priest was or something, that he was going to go and have all of his sins absolved. And so he went to the gas station and they wouldn't sell him gas, and he ended up taking the gas and said, it doesn't matter because we're all going to die. There was another story of a well-known guy who actually owned our grocery store at the time. His name was Albert Frank. He was downriver with his family. When he drove back into town, he reportedly saw women and children in the street screaming and crying, and he stopped his car, got out, gathered them up, and brought them into one of the Main Street businesses to try to get them calmed down. So there were all these confused conversations happening. People really didn't know.
How did it begin to become apparent that it wasn't an actual alien invasion?
I read in the Concrete Herald that it really was the next day before people were kind of laughing about it, but at first it wasn't funny at all. Many people were panicked.
Do you have any other sense of like what it was like for those folks to discover that they had kind of been fooled?
You know, some people were mad. The other thing that was happening at that time, obviously, it was right before World War II broke out, and there were a lot of fears anyway, and so people were really paying attention to the radio and really listening to what was happening elsewhere in the world, and so a lot of people were really on edge anyway. In fact, I did hear that people actually thought it was the Germans coming. It wasn't the Martians after all. But here's the weird thing. I also have read a lot of people looking back now and saying what really it was about the media and about how newspapers blew it all up as a way of saying you cannot trust radio.
I never thought of that. They were big competitors at the time.
Big competitors, and because radio was really new on the scene and taking away some of the advertising dollars from the newspapers, they took advantage of this story to prove that you better not listen to the radio for your news because they just couldn't be trusted. And I just looked at the November 1st edition of the Concrete Herald has an article on the front page about the fake news and about the radio broadcast and how much it scared everybody.
And that got picked up elsewhere too, right?
Oh, I
mean,
yes.
Wasn't it in the New York Times?
Yes, it was in the New York Times. It was on the front page of the Boston Globe. You know, I've read articles about how this was the beginning of the people losing their faith in the media. Because all of a sudden, you had to be very careful what you believe. You know, it was the first time anybody had ever heard of this little tiny town in the Pacific Northwest. It was just a very odd coincidence.
Well, Val Stafford is proprietor of the Concrete Theater, as well as head of the Concrete Chamber of Commerce, Woman About Town. Thank you so much for sharing a little bit of Concrete's history with us.
I'm very happy to. Thank you.
This is Sound Effect. Gabriel Spitzer here. Before we conclude our What Are the Odds show, I'd like to turn it over to Dick Stein for one last installment of The Card Room Tales. This one was recorded for a segment that he used to do called Jazz Kitchen.
Poker players hate to get up from the table. God forbid they should miss that hand that'll make them a huge score. So we do two things. One, cultivate superhuman bladder control. And two, When we're hungry, we'll just order something and eat it right there at the table. Now, the only occasion I've seen in which this created a problem occurred in an amusing little 10-20 hold'em game I was involved in a few years ago in a vile dump in Laughlin, Nevada. I'm sitting there folding one junk hand after another when I discover a pair of queens in the hole. The dealer must have made a mistake and dealt these to me. Pocket queens is a real nice starting hand in hold'em, and I put in a raise. Now, since I haven't played a hand in like 30 minutes, the other players put me on a powerhouse, and it's folded around this big fat loud guy, talks like this, sitting there with his shirt open and his pants unbuttoned, and he's holding this huge, messy plate of lasagna right up to his mouth and shoveling it in as he plays. And he's shoveling the chips in, too. This man is a maniac. He will bet, raise, and re-raise on anything or nothing. Often. I know this, and I'm not surprised when he re-raises me. And that runs out the remaining two players, and because I know he is a maniac, I still like my queens, and I re-raise him right back. He just takes another gigantic mouthful of lasagna, grunts, and says, "Call." The dealer lays out the flop. It's a four, a six, and a beautiful queen. All different suits, no flush draw. I got three queens. I like this flop. I bet this flop. He raises. I re-raise. Maniac holds the plate to his greasy lips, scrapes in another colossal mouthful of drippy lasagna, and caps it with the last raise permitted. I call. Next card, a nine. Don't look scary to me. Queens rule. I bet him out again. He raises again. I re-raise. He says, "I don't give a damn. I gotta go to jail this afternoon anyway." And he caps it with his last 20. But just as the dealer is about to lay out the final card, Maniac front loads another hunk of lasagna and starts choking. Pandemonium. Another player gets his arms around him and starts working the Heimlich maneuver. And at exactly the same time that the dealer burns and turns the last card, this wad of lasagna the size of a tennis ball catapults out of his mouth and lands right on the card before anyone can see what it is. Should tell you a lot about poker players that everyone finds this just hilarious. But there's a ton of chips out there, and I want them. I say, "Well, what is it?" The dealer says,
"I'm not touching that."
Heimlich boy reaches out, picks up the gob of expelled lasagna, absentmindedly tucks it back in his mouth, and the card is revealed as a sauce-smeared eight. I turn over my set of queens. Lasagna slob brays out, "What a river!" and shows me the only two cards that can beat me, a five and a seven for a straight. And as the pasta pig rakes in this huge pot, another player says,
"Could we have a new deck, please?"
And the game rolls on.
KNKX Jazz host Dick Stein escorting us to the end of another show. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing with Janae Janik. We had help this week from Shane Mailing, Dominic Black, Emma Jones, Ryan McDonald, and Adam Cox. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer, and we get multimedia help from Parker Miles Blom. You know, every day is Saturday when you subscribe to the Sound Effect podcast, and you can listen whenever you feel like it. Find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and look us up on Facebook under KNKX Sound Effect. Come on back next week when our theme is "Lend Me Your Ears." I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.